In our new series, World War II's Greatest Battles, we chart five pivotal moments that shaped the course of the conflict with military historian James Holland. New episodes drop every Thursday on the History Extra podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Welcome to the History Extra podcast. Fascinating historical conversations from the makers of BBC History Magazine. It was a titanic struggle involving three of the world's greatest powers: Germany, Austria-Hungary, and Russia. It spanned more than twice the distance of the trenches in Flanders and France, and it cast the longest of shadows over the 20th century, called by Winston Churchill, incomparably the greatest war in history. Spencer Mizzen sat down with Nick Lloyd, Professor of Modern Warfare at King's College London, to discuss everything you wanted to know about the First World War's Eastern Front.
Hi, Nick. Thank you for joining us today. Now, I wonder if you could start by giving our listeners a brief introduction to the fighting on the Eastern Front during the First World War. Which nations were embroiled in the fighting, and what were the chief milestones in the conflict?
Well, that's a very big question, because you've got the three big empires that the war starts in the east. Obviously, we have the contest between Serbia and the Austro-Hungarian Habsburg Empire. That's really the engine and motor of the war. The assassination of Franz Ferdinand in Sarajevo. And so that's where the war begins. And of course, it spirals out of control very, very quickly and drags in the Russian Empire. And of course, Germany, who is Austria's main ally. And so that's what we would term the Eastern Front. And that, very quickly spirals into one of the worst wars in history, really, in terms of the amount of bloodshed, in terms of the amount of sheer destruction that it actually deals. And so you get something which none of the powers had really anticipated would be as bad as it is. And it's a very strange opening of the Eastern Front, because all those powers that I've mentioned, they don't necessarily really want to be fighting where they're fighting. And so that's kind of an interesting one, because obviously Austria-Hungary is really intent on smashing Serbia, on contesting that power in the Balkans and getting rid of a quite troublesome, minor power. And so it wants to be free to smash Serbia. And obviously the Russians don't want to allow this. And so the Russians want to take on Austria. And, the Russians they believe that they have territorial gains and they have areas of the Austro-Hungarian Empire that they would like to expand into. And so they would like to fight against the Austrians. But of course, the main player and, the most important power in this is, of course, Germany and what Germany does. And Germany doesn't want to fight on the Eastern Front. It wants to fight because of the kind of inflexibility of its war plan, the now infamous Schlieffen plan. Germany wants to fight on the Western Front. It wants to crush France very quickly, within 4 to 6 weeks. And so 7/8 of its army are going to go west. And so they don't want to fight the Russians because the Russians will be slow to mobilize. The Russians will probably get stronger as the war goes on. The Russians have inexhaustible manpower. And so for Germany, it has to say to Austria, look, if we're going to help you, you need to put most of your army against Russia, not Serbia. Serbia's irrelevant. You can crush Serbia once the Russians are dealt with. And so it's a very, certainly for the Central Powers, it's a very strange opening to the war because they're really at odds in terms of the strategy. And Russia is also split because it wants to fight against the Habsburg Empire, as I mentioned, but it might never have a better chance of making serious gains against the Germans because, of course, there's only one German army in East Prussia. And so if they're going to fight Germany, they should go now. They should concentrate everything against Germany and drive on to Berlin, which is what the French, Russia's main ally, wants them to do. And so it's a very contested and complex opening. And it kind of goes on from there, really, in terms of the conduct of the war. And you have a series of enormous battles in August and September 1914, where the Austrians are sort of being dragged back to fight the Russians. Germany wins at Tannenberg, the Battle of Tannenberg in East Prussia, where they're able to effectively end the Russian invasion. And then what happens is it becomes really evident that the Austrians are very, very weak. They're weak in firepower, they're weak in cohesion, they've lost a lot of officers in those early battles. And so Germany has to consistently bail them out, has to consistently send troops from the west to the east. So about a third of Germany's troops throughout the war are on the Eastern Front. And so Germany is effectively forced to continue to provide support to the Austrians and then have to take offensive operations themselves, which they do in the May of 1915 at the Gorlice-Tarnow offensive, which is a very successful offensive when Germany really pushes back the Russians into what we call the Great Retreat. And so there is enormous amount of fighting in the first sort of 18 months of the war. Russia does recover. It recovers and attacks the Austrians again in 1916 at what becomes the Brusilov offensive. But by this point, the Eastern Front, by the summer and late summer of 1916, the Eastern Front is kind of reaching its culminating moment where the Austrians are very, very weak. The Germans effectively control them now. But despite the success they've had against the Austrians, the Russians are, of course, as we know, becoming increasingly fragmented, increasingly disaffected at home, political strife, strikes. And so obviously you get the position at the turn of the year where we go into 1917, where Russia begins to have serious problems. And of course, you have the abdication of the Tsar in March 1917. And so that's just some of the indications of a quite a strange war in many ways.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
The holidays have arrived early with Blinds.com's Spring Black Friday sale. Upgrading window coverings can be a minor project with a major impact. Blinds.com makes it easy and affordable. Browse premium blinds, shades, shutters. We have your patio covered too. And get unlimited window treatments installed for one low cost. Free shipping and Blinds.com's 100% satisfaction guarantee. Shop Blinds.com's Spring Black Friday sale now. Save up to 45% plus premium doorbusters. Up to 45% off at Blinds.com. Rules and restrictions may apply.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
You wrote a feature on the Eastern Front for the April issue of BBC History magazine. Now, in that, the Eastern Front is described as the forgotten theater of the First World War, one that, according to one historian, has kind of long existed in a deep freeze. Now, one of our followers on social media, Kristen Finch, wants to know why that is. She asks on Facebook, why has the experience of the Eastern Front been overshadowed for so long by the Western Front?
Yeah, I mean, that is a great question. And I think there are a number of reasons why this is the case. I think the Western Front in my view, is the decisive theatre of the war, where the decision is ultimately reached. That's where Germany loses and it's where the Allies win. But the Eastern Front has so many after effects. Obviously, it changes the landscape of Eastern Europe, the Balkans, you know, Russia. And so it has huge effects. But I think one of the reasons why it hasn't had the attention has been difficulty of languages, difficulty of getting access to the sources. The fact that I think that it was felt that it was a war that hadn't really gone the way that anyone had expected. You know, Germany loses, Austria loses, Russia loses. And so I think that's one of the reasons why there wasn't that much attention paid to it, because I think everyone really wanted to forget about it because it had been such a horrendous experience for everybody. I think for the Western Front, you know, the Allies win on the Western Front. And I think there's obviously a lot of attention to that. And I think for Germany as well, there's a lot of trying to work out why they had lost on the Western Front. The Eastern Front is quite different. And for many years, the only real account we had in English was Norman Stone's 1975 book, The Eastern Front, which is an excellent, it's a classic account. And it's only really in recent decades that historians have begun to examine elements of this story in more detail, looking at archive records that have become available. But it's still much lower, I think. The attention is much lower than you get on the Western Front, which makes it, I think, certainly from my perspective, a much fresher front, a much more interesting front, I think, in many ways, and one that's, you know, has so many kind of wider implications going forward.
Okay, so let's go back to the beginning, because in your feature in the magazine, you observe that the origins of the First World War can only be truly understood by looking at the power dynamics of Eastern Europe and the Balkans in 1914. So, I mean, what were those dynamics? What was the balance of power? How did the killing of Archduke Franz Ferdinand trigger what Winston Churchill would later describe as the greatest war in history?
Yeah, I mean, that's a question that's puzzled, you know, generations of historians. You know, how does this assassination of this rather obscure figure trigger this great cataclysm? And I think you have declining empire in the Habsburg Empire, you have a rising nationalist power like Serbia, you have a situation where great empires are kind of peering into the Balkans and wanting to have their share. You have, I think, a kind of waiting for the Ottomans to collapse. And so, you know, both Russia and Austria would like to get in on the action, so to speak, when the Ottoman Empire collapses, as everyone thinks it will. You obviously have Germany. I mean, and in a sense, there isn't, you know, Germany is the reason why it becomes this great war, I think. And it's Germany's missteps in terms of containing, controlling the situation and actually pushing things that mean they spiral into a global catastrophe. But I think the assassination, I think, highlights concerns in Austria that are they going to just take this lying down? Is this a symptom of a kind of declining power that is not able and willing to fight back and actually dominate the region in the way that it once had? And so they fear the rise of Serbia is going to destabilize the region and ultimately break their own empire up, or at least contribute to that. And so they want to make a stand. And I think it's a very human emotion, of course, but it's completely misguided in terms of the capability that Austria has, but also the chaos that any war would unleash. And I think you've obviously got the Russian role as well, which is crucial. And Russia is a power that's rearming, that's becoming stronger in the years before the war. And I think everyone fears them. They fear that actually this is a power that is going to become really, really strong. Germany certainly fears Russia. And one of the reasons the advice to the Kaiser is to do this now, to go now, is because if we wait, the assumption is that Russia will be too strong. So therefore, we have a window of opportunity to strike now while they are not as strong as they will become. And so you can see a whole range of different decisions that are made, which produces the war that, you know, we have the kind of global catastrophe that then spirals into the Western Front, brings the Brits in. And that, of course, turns that into a global war.
Now, George Haig is written in to ask if you could describe the relative strengths and weaknesses of the three chief combatants on the Eastern Front, Germany, Austria-Hungary, and Russia. So, yeah, I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the challenges that faced each of these three combatants and, you know, how did they rise to the challenge?
Well, I think we'll start with Austria. I mean, the Habsburg Empire has been, you know, largely written off as this kind of power that's really useless. Its army is undoubtedly weak. There's no doubt about that. It's weak in firepower, as I mentioned. Its artillery is very light compared to other armies. They don't have that many guns. And so it goes into battle largely based on infantry firepower, rifles. It is also the most fragmented ethnically. So, you know, you have all different types of speakers in the empire. And I think that gives it a fragility and a lack of commonality. Now, there is the language of the officers of the across the empire should be either Hungarian or German. But obviously, once those officers get killed or wounded, which they do quite rapidly when the war breaks out, you have that breaking of those bonds between the men and the officers. And often you get replacements who maybe don't speak the regimental language of that unit. And so Austria is fragile, and very quickly Austria struggles to coordinate operations, to attack properly. And, you know, they have places where they perform very well. They perform quite well on the east, on the Italian front against the Italians, because they're in good defensive positions and they show a kind of cohesion and a kind of fighting spirit that's often lacking in other places. But really by 1915, 1916, the Austrians are increasingly indebted to the Germans who are beginning to take over that army. So they occupy key positions across the army, usually the chief of staff of any major unit. And they begin to filter in selected German officers and NCOs, German equipment into those divisions, which only becomes more prominent as the war goes on. And so by 1916, you have kind of unified command where the Austrians are basically, you know, been taken over by the Germans. Now, if we look at the Germans, you know, the Germans have, by common consent, the best army in the world in 1914. It's got lots of good artillery. It's very well trained. It has deep reserves of manpower, reserves of officers. It knows what it wants to do. And so, you know, the German army is clearly going to be the best one. And most of that, of course, is sent against France. The problem for the Germans is that they've left East Prussia, you know, deliberately weak, because they want to be able to, you know, concentrate their force against France. But what happens quite quickly is they begin to realize that actually the Russians are not as good as maybe we thought they would. And therefore, maybe we can actually do more in the East. Maybe we can actually win in the East this time instead of the West. And so that becomes quite an important debate within the German high command, is should we stay on the defensive in the West, or at least when it bogs down by the end of 1914, can we actually win in the East? And so you see a kind of power struggle between the commanders in the East and their commander Falkenhayn in the West for resources. And they're continually asking Hindenburg and Ludendorff, the great duo on the East, they're continually asking for more support, because they think the Russians can be taken. For Russia, I think, you know, they have the biggest army in the world. It takes them a while to get going. But they're certainly strong against the Austrians. They have more artillery than the Austrians. There's a toughness to the Russian divisions, I think, which the Austrians don't have. So it takes quite a while to wear down the Russians. I think there's a certain lack of subtlety to Russian tactics early in the war, where they come forward en masse. But they do have more firepower, and they have more recent experience in the Russo-Japanese War. And so they have an awareness of the kind of challenges they're going to face on the modern battlefield. So there's a continual complaint from the Austrians that as soon as they see Russians, the Russians start digging in. The Russians are always digging in, because they're aware of the power of artillery and how exposed they're going to be if they don't. And so they have a kind of, there's a streetwise sort of nature to the Russians, I think, which the Austrians don't really have, at least initially. The problem for the Russians is, I mean, there's problems at the tactical level, but in terms of strategy, they are split. So they're constantly split between wanting to concentrate against the Austrians, because they know they're weaker and they want to gain that territory up to, push the empire down to the Carpathians. But they're having to fight the Germans. And so they put two armies into East Prussia in August of 1914, but they're, one of which is basically annihilated at the Battle of Tannenberg, which is probably the most decisive battle of the war. And so really from that point onwards, the invasion of East Prussia collapses. And from that point onwards, the Russian high command are very queasy about concentrating against Germany. But there is a continual debate about where do we concentrate resources, because we can't really leave the Germans alone, particularly when the German divisions start coming onto the Eastern Front. But the problem they have is that however much success they have against the Austrians, and they do have quite a lot of success against them, certainly in 1916, whenever they do, the Germans just pour in divisions, and so they're never really able to exploit the success. And so that's one of the problems the Russians have, is they haven't really worked out who they want to fight. Or at least they have, but they haven't worked out a strategy for dealing with essentially a two-front war in the north and the south. And that's one of the main bugbears they have to deal with throughout the war, who to concentrate on and where they should fight.
Now, towards the end of the war, Tsar Nicholas II appointed himself, didn't he, the commander of Russian forces. I mean, what kind of impact did that have in the conduct of the war and Russian success or lack of success in the East?
Well, the commander at the start of the war is Grand Duke Nikolai Nikolaevich, who obviously related to the Tsar. He is a soldier. He's quite long experience, but he isn't familiar with Russia's deployment plans. And so he hasn't designed the plan that goes to war. But he struggles, I think, to coordinate operations. And he says to one of the French officers, he said, well, you can never be sure in this empire whether, you know, give an order, whether anything will actually happen, you know, how far it will go down the chain of command and whether you will actually, it will be enacted. And he really struggles to decide where he wants to fight, whether he wants to fight against the Germans or the Austrians. And so he kind of goes one way and he goes the other. And, you know, I think he tries his best, but there are limitations in terms of communications. It's a huge front. And there's limitations in terms of how he deals with his senior officers. He doesn't particularly like conflict. And so he's not necessarily the kind of man that is going to really knock heads together and really demand obedience. He's a little bit weak on that front. At least that's the general perception of him. And obviously you have this great retreat in the summer of 1915 when the Germans strike against Russia. And, you know, the losses are horrific. There's about 1 million people they lose, and they lose most of Poland, the Baltic states, what will become the Baltic states. And so the Tsar is sort of toying with this. And in September 1915, he moves Nikolaevich to the Caucasus and he takes personal command. It doesn't necessarily really change that much on the ground. Most of the work is being done by General Alexeyev, who's the chief of staff, who's the main, you know, soldier in command of operations, and he briefs the Tsar. But I think the point that most historians make about it, it means that the Tsar is much more directly related to the war effort and the success and failure of Russian arms. And so if he's warned before he does this, you know, if things go wrong, that you will be blamed. And this is not necessarily a good thing. You know, it's always good if you can fire someone, but if you can't fire yourself. And so if things go wrong, then that will inevitably have political ramifications. And so the Tsar dismisses this, and he's sort of convinced that actually he will save Russia. This is God's will. He will take command. This is the moment that he is going to lead Russia's armies to victory. And ultimately, that's not the case. So it doesn't necessarily have an immediate impact on the ground, but it means that the Tsar is much more closely associated with success or failure.
Hugh Birkmeyer asks, how fluid was the Eastern Front? Was it a war of movement, or was it tied up in trenches like its counterpart in the West? I wonder also, could you answer at the same time a question of my own that I've added, and that is, how did the Eastern Front compare to the West in terms of its size, of its scale?
Yeah, and I think that's probably the most obvious difference with the West. It's about 3 times longer, over 1,000 kilometers, sometimes even more, obviously depending on the period of the war. But you have huge differences in terrain. I mean, there's a huge and absolutely terrible battle in the Carpathians in the winter of 1914-1915, you know, fighting amidst deep snow and mountain cliffs. I mean, it's really terrible. You have deep forests of Poland and in the Baltic region. You have wide open plains of Galicia and western Ukraine. And so the experience of the Eastern Front is very much more defined by the landscape and the geography, the topography of those states that it's fought over. And so it is very different. And often what you tend to see is when troops who've been on the Western Front, they come east, and particularly I'm talking about German soldiers, they're kind of almost overwhelmed by the size and scale of the East. And it is a very strange experience for them, these sort of endless forests, endless plains, that it becomes, it's quite a shock to them. And I think that feeds into the way the East is seen as sort of a different place where different rules apply. And so the size and scale is really important. Now, going to the question about maneuver, now it is always more, there's always more maneuver and there's always more space on the East than the West. I mean, you do get trenches, you know, you get trenches in 1915, you get small entrenchments that get firmer as the war goes on. You get quite heavily defended positions in 1916. But you never get the kind of concentration of force that you would have in the West, where there isn't really room to breathe. It's much more concentrated. In the East, there's always room for breakthroughs. There's always room for flanking attacks or something. And so if you can break through at certain points, you can maneuver more effectively. One of the problems the Russians have is that they don't have that many railways leading to and from and across up and down the front. And so they can hold the front, but if they get a local breakthrough, it's more difficult for them to send reserves in. It can take a lot longer for them to do that. So they find it difficult to, you know, it's much easier to do that in the Western Front, for example, with certainly the British and French find there's railways everywhere. And so they can move troops strategically much easier. They can't really do that in the Eastern Front. And so it tends to be much more, you know, cavalry based and, you know, long marches that, for the infantry. So it is a much more maneuverable war. And I think that has consequences in terms of the kind of fighting that we see. But it certainly does see trenches, and there are periods where the fighting is very low level, and so it tends to be much more positional.
Now, Trace A asks, how deadly was the Eastern Front? I mean, you've already alluded to the brutality, sheer bloodiness of the conflict. We've got, you know, these quotes from Churchill describing it as the greatest war in history. So yeah, I wonder if you could tell us just a little bit about exactly how brutal it was.
Yeah, I mean, it is extremely brutal. And you look at the Russian casualties, you look at Austrian casualties, it's absolutely phenomenal, I think, how much slaughter is contained within that front. And obviously Germany loses most of their people on the Western Front, because that's where most of the army is for most of the war. But the casualties in the East are not inconsiderable. About 2 million casualties for the Austrians. I mean, the Austrians just, they bleed very, very, you know, prodigiously early in the war. I mean, there's an example between January and April of 1915, when they're trying to, you know, they're trying to press forward in the Carpathians, multiple different offensives in terrible conditions. They lose over 790,000 casualties, 750,000 casualties in about 3 months. I mean, it's absolutely mind-boggling, the losses. And that's in just one period. So by that, you know, by the spring of 1915, the Austrians are almost, they're almost a rabble, they're a militia. The spine of the army is gone. And it's actually something of a miracle that they're able to limp, as, you know, on as much as they are into 1918, or actually be able to keep going. It's absolutely incredible, really. Russian casualties are always slightly vague. I mean, certainly they're going to lose at least 1 million in 1915, estimates upwards of 4 million, maybe more. And so, you know, Russian casualties are very, very heavy. Even in the summer of 1916, they lose about 1 million casualties as well, with multiple different armies that are attacking. And so the level of slaughter in the East is certainly comparable to the West, indeed, if probably even worse. You also have in the East, you have some more violence against civilians as well. So you have more ethnic elements of ethnic cleansing, particularly with Jews, get kind of moved on by both sides as they advance and retreat. And so you do tend to get more of the kind of violence against civilians that obviously adds that casualty rate up, which is largely absent in the West. I mean, the French and the Belgians aren't treated particularly well, but they're not subject to the kind of abuse that the subject populations often get in the Eastern Front.
Is that kind of a product of the bitterness that had existed between different ethnic groups before the conflict erupted?
Yeah, I mean, it is. I think obviously you've got a lot of different ethnic groups in that whole region. And as, you know, Russia is going to, you know, advance into it, it wants to sort of take away certain ethnic groups from the Austrians. And obviously that's one of the great weaknesses of the Austrian Empire, is the kind of, you know, the fact that it's so many different ethnicities within it. It has a common identity, but that can be kind of prized apart quite easily. And obviously, you know, the Germans and the Austrians are looking at the Poles to become independent, or at least, you know, independent of the Tsar. And you have different national groups within there. So there's lots of different national groups. And of course, as the war, you know, progresses and you have a lot of movement, you know, you have a lot of advance and you have huge retreats, that's where the population tends to become a target, because they fear that certain groups are going to be either pro-Central Powers or pro-Russia, and so they will treat them accordingly. And so it's a combination of the nature of the region and the ethnicities and the national groupings within the region, but also the fact that you have these massive advances and retreats as well.
Now, this is a very long campaign peppered with lots of battles, and obviously it goes without saying that we can't mention every one, but I was wondering if maybe you could pick out two or three battles that really changed the course of this war, that really defined the fighting on the Eastern Front.
Yeah, I mean, I think the Battle of Tannenberg, as I've already mentioned, is that clash between the Russian army and the German army in East Prussia. And it's one of the most celebrated victories in German history, where the German 8th Army was able to disengage from the other Russian army and then move around and surround the second Russian army and then destroy it, or at least destroy most of it in this kind of great cauldron battle. And so this was a stunning vindication of German planning, German operational skill, German tactics, and so on. And it really gives the German army a huge sort of moral advantage over the Russians, almost for the entire war, when the Russians become very aware that they have to be very, very careful with engaging with the Germans because they're capable of this kind of maneuver. And so Tannenberg really sets the seal on the East, and it raises the possibility that Germany can actually win in the East in a way that perhaps it hadn't anticipated. I think you also get, I mean, there are a number of very, very big battles on the kind of Galician front with the Austrians. I thought even something like the opening battle of Frasnik in August, almost taking place almost at the same time as Tannenberg, where the Austrians, they're able to mass, they have an advantage, they have a numerical advantage over a wing of the Russian army, and they're able to almost, they try to do a Tannenberg, they try to get around and surround the Russians, and they're able to destroy, I think, about one corps, but not three or four corps that the Germans do. And I think the cost is so high, there was about 40,000 casualties within a few days. And so it illustrates that even on their best day, when, you know, everything almost went right for them, they almost did it. And ultimately, that's the high point of the Habsburg army almost. They're never really able to go on the offensive again. And after Krasnik and the casualties they suffered and the heavy losses, they basically forced into a retreat, and that really doesn't really end. And also, I think something like you've got the Gorlitz-Tarnow offensive of the following year, where, you know, that shows sort of new tactics and techniques that the Germans bring to the Eastern Front, heavy artillery, concentrated hurricane bombardments, and are able to concentrate forces at the right position. You've got the Brusilov offensive of 1916, where Russia is able to learn and develop and have more, you know, have to concentrate against the Austrians and actually be very, very successful. They destroy an entire Austrian army within about 3 days. And so, you know, that's an important battle. You've got Riga the following year, where Germany deploys a lot of new tactics. Again, stormtroop tactics are used for the first time, concentrated gas shelling. So I could go on, but there are a few, they are kind of probably the standout kind of engagements, which each in their own way are very, very important.
Now, you've touched upon it a few times there, and you refer to it in the feature you've written in the magazine. You say kind of that the Eastern Front was an essential laboratory of war, where new tactics were refined before often being used elsewhere. But I wonder if you could go into a little bit more detail there. I mean, what new tactics were trialed during the fighting in the East, and how were they then used elsewhere in the First World War?
Well, if we look at Germany, I mean, Germany uses the Eastern Front as a laboratory, as I said. It can try things out in the East and see how they go before they may wish to deploy them on the Western Front or even something like the Italian Front as well. And so the first German use of gas occurs on the Eastern Front at Bolimov in Russian Poland in January of 1915. Doesn't particularly work very well, but they are quite intrigued with what gas can do. And then obviously the planning is then taken forward to use gas on the Western Front. I think one of the most celebrated examples of tactics on the Eastern Front is the attack at Riga, which I've mentioned, where by this point of the war, there's been enormous development of the way offensive shock tactics are conducted. And so they have a situation where they want to take Riga, and so they put all these things into practice. And by that point in the war, offensive tactics are very, very modern. And so you have a very short, intensive bombardment. You have a blanketing of gas shelling, particularly on enemy gun positions. So you'll sort of bombard their gun positions with gas. You'll gain control of the air with air power. You'll have specially trained squads, heavily armed squads, often armed with sort of light machine guns and grenades that will infiltrate through positions and through the lines. That's always easier to do against the Russians than it is on the Western Front, where the lines are much more concentrated. And so you can try something out at Riga, and it's very successful. And so you can kind of hone the tactics, and you can hone the integration between the artillery and the infantry, and look at what kind of concentration of gas you need, how long should the bombardment be. And so Riga is used, firstly, the tactics of Riga are used at Caporetto against the Italians, again, very successfully, and on a larger scale on the Western Front in the spring of 1918.
How invested were powers like Britain and France in the West in what was going on in the Eastern Front? I guess to an extent, the two were inextricably linked, weren't they? Because just in terms of the resources that the Eastern Front diverted away from the trenches in Flanders and France.
the Allies are very invested in what's happening in the East. The links are limited. You know, there's limited cooperation. The cooperation in terms of operations is almost simply that, well, you know, if you guys can attack on a certain date, then we will attack in the West, you know, close to that date as well. So it's pretty rudimentary. But you do see examples like the French with the Romanians. It's quite, you know, quite close cooperation. And so there is, you know, there's an awareness of that. And I think if you look at the way that Germany shifts divisions back and forth, there's no doubt that the East becomes, you know, a significant drain on resources and a significant part of the war that they can't ignore.
Right. Here's a question that's very popular among internet search queries, and that is, how did the Eastern Front come to an end? And how did the Russian Revolution accelerate that process?
Well, by 1916, the front is pretty static. You know, the line has gone, you know, the Germans obviously advanced into Poland, into the Baltic states. And, you know, the Romania has come in, but that's not been decisive. And so the line is pretty straight and it's sort of bogged down, really. But you have the abdication of the Tsar, first of all, and then Russia enters a period of political chaos where they form a sort of coalition government, a provisional government, as it's known. And that struggles on, and it tries to continue to fight the war under the banner of you know, a republic and freedom and sort of Russian nationalism, but it really struggles to do that. And there are various offensives on the East, but they're short-lived and they don't particularly work. And so by and large, fighting comes to an end in 1917. But it's not really until the Bolshevik takeover of power in November of 1917 that things become very, very chaotic, even more chaotic than they already had been. And the Bolsheviks very quickly signal that they want almost peace at any price. And so you have the negotiations at Brest-Litovsk, which ultimately bring about the end of the Eastern Front as we know it in March of 1918. But it's very difficult because the Bolsheviks aren't really, their writ doesn't run across the entirety of Russia. And obviously you have a significant element of the army which heads south that will be the, you know, the volunteer movement or the whites. And so Russia, by the end of 1917 into 1918, is on the precipice of a very, very bloody civil war. And so Russia's collapse is like a great vacuum that's opened up in the front. And it's, you know, it's very disorientating for everyone involved when they see this happening, because it's simply mind-boggling how awful it's become. And I think the very sad thing about Russia's experience is it starts off very testing and it gets worse and it just keeps getting worse, the experience. It's really, 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 really horrible. But yeah, you get the end of the front technically in March of 1918, but it doesn't mean that this is kind of quiet. I mean, Germany has to garrison, I believe, about 1 million troops in the East to garrison the areas that it's overrun. And it's constantly aware of Bolshevik subversion, so that it means that it isn't really stable. They try and support Ukraine, but it's not really possible. And so the region is in real, you know, a real unstable situation, which means that even though fighting has ended, it's not really safe.
And how did the withdrawal of Russia from the conflict affect events in the West?
Well, once you have, you know, the indication from the Bolsheviks that they will do anything for peace as long as they can save their revolution, Germany is very, very quickly aware that this gives them a window of opportunity. And so they can ship quite a lot of troops over to the Western Front during the winter. And then, of course, which gives them a temporary superiority on the Western Front. And of course, that really brings the final act of the Great War onto the Western Front, where Germany will attack in the spring of 1918 before the Americans can arrive in strength. And so the collapse of Russia has a very direct impact on what happens in the West.
And finally, Nick, in summary, what was the chief legacy, in your opinion, of the war on the Eastern Front? How did it impact the future of Europe going forward over the next two or three decades?
Yeah, I mean, I think the key takeaway for me is the war doesn't really end in the East. It just sort of mutates and changes into a different kind of war. Obviously, Russia goes into civil war. You have the establishment of the Soviet Union, very bloody civil war. Almost as many people are killed in that as are killed in the Russian army in the First World War. The collapse of the Habsburg Empire has huge implications for Central Eastern Europe in terms of the states, the successor states that will rise up, often weak, susceptible to communism. The Italians struggle out of the war. They win, but there's a feeling that hasn't really been worth it. And of course, that contributes to the rise of fascism. And obviously you have Germany who, you know, the situation in the East and the fact that they had essentially won in the East means that another generation of German soldiers and German officers and, you know, Adolf Hitler will think that I can do it again. And so it has a very direct impact on what happens into the Second World War. And the idea that Russia can be defeated becomes a very, very strong idea within the Nazi Party. And the idea that, you know, the Eastern Front can be reclaimed and can be conquered again. And so the Eastern Front, you know, we have that very clear delineation in the West where fighting ends on the 11th of November, but it never really happens in the East. The war just carries on, I think, in a way that means that it still has many legacies that we can learn about.
That was Nick Lloyd. His book, The Eastern Front, A History of the First World War, is published by Viking. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Jack Bateman.